And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman on this Wednesday afternoon. Well, this hour we discuss Florida's most notorious Ponzi scheme operator, Scott Rothstein. He built Fort Lauderdale's richest law firm, but was convicted of bilking some $1.4 billion from hundreds of individuals and charities. With us is South Floridian and public relations expert Chuck Malkus. After some 3 years of research, he's published The Ultimate Ponzi, the Scott Rothstein Story. Welcome to you, Chuck Malkus.
Thank you, Joe.
And welcome. Good to have you. It seems that Scott Rothstein was really eclipsed by Bernie Madoff. Just tell us how they were different and how they were alike, if at all.
Sure, Bonnie. Well, first of all, he was only eclipsed by numbers by Bernie Madoff. Scott Rothstein had more flair, showmanship, and overall greed than Bernie Madoff ever thought of. And Scott Rothstein was also someone who took advantage of charities, who was a man who made himself an overnight philanthropist. And Scott Rothstein, he was out in front, unlike anything that we had seen in South Florida before. And for those reasons, Scott Rothstein was much different than Bernie Madoff.
How about the basics of how a Ponzi scheme works? Is it stealing from Peter to pay Paul and oneself?
Exactly. And Ponzi schemes rely on a flow of money that's coming in to basically pay for investors, and the returns typically are anywhere from 15% to 30%.
What was he like in his early years?
Well, first of all, going back to high school, his former classmates express in the Ultimate Ponzi book that he was a fantastic singer. He was almost the choir boy who couldn't get a date with the homecoming queen. But he had a voice, and that voice made him a charming individual. Then at law school at Nova Southeastern, one of his former classmates in the book states that he was a savvy guy when it came time to be on stage, and that he was somebody who had the personality to convince you that his argument was the right one.
Sort of a ham.
He was a ham.
Yeah, you paint a picture of a very charismatic, charming, manipulative man. Do you think that's what made him in part responsible for, were those things responsible for his great success at scheming people and scamming people?
Yes, Bonnie. He could make you feel like you were a best friend in about 10 minutes of time. And in a half hour, he would have your trust of most people, due to that personality.
Or trust literally.
Well, correct.
With the dollars.
Right. So when did this begin? When did he begin? You said his law firm started with four people and went to 150 people. How did this happen?
Well, first of all, the law firm got started in 2002. And for Scott Rothstein to begin to build this law firm, he did need a reputation of a well-known attorney, and so he was able to convince Stuart Rosenfeld to join him at the firm. And unfortunately, that choice by Stuart Rosenfeld would end up hurting him significantly, but it allowed Scott Rothstein to bring in other attorneys. And then once they had other well-known attorneys, he added former law enforcement, he added former judges, and he created a law firm unlike any other in South Florida in such a short period of time. The Ponzi is believed to have begun in 2005.
In 2002, in the book, you talk about that Rothstein had his introduction to politics alongside Charlie Crist. Explain that.
Certainly. What happened was that Scott Rothstein went to a Charlie Crist fundraiser when Mr. Crist was running for Attorney General. And Scott Rothstein was fascinated by the power and by the circumstance of politics. Later, when the Ponzi was going, Charlie Crist hosted fundraisers at his mansion for John McCain, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Charlie Crist, and others.
So tell us about how he did this. He used structured settlements. Can those be legal? Are they legal?
Yes, structured settlements. And sometimes you may see a television ad. If you're involved in a personal injury case, a sexual harassment case, a whistleblower case, these settlements can result in payments over a period of 5 years. And so if you choose to receive all the money up front, or not all the money, let's say a good portion of the money up front, you engage with one of these structured settlements companies. There was only one problem. Rothstein was selling structured settlements that simply did not exist.
Now, how could nobody have known this?
Well, when Scott Rothstein was selling these settlements to investors, he would state that due to confidentiality, due to
attorney-client
correct, that he could not divulge the details.
It's pretty amazing. You say that he outsmarted these really savvy and intelligent investors. How did he do that?
Well, he did it by simply portraying himself as a power broker and as somebody who was so engaged in politics and charity circles. I mean, the other thing that's unbelievable is that when Charlie Crist became governor, he appointed Scott Rothstein to the Judicial Nominating Board. The board which makes recommendations on the appointment of judges by the governor. I mean, that's a pretty powerful person.
So he had him hoodwinked as well.
He had it hoodwinked. You know, he was one of Charlie Crist's best friends. And on Charlie Crist's 52nd birthday, there was a fundraising effort of which if you paid $1,000, you would blow out one of the candles on the birthday cake. Well, Scott Rothstein said, I'll buy all 52. And Scott Rothstein blew out the 52 candles on Charlie Crist's birthday cake.
$52,000 to blow out the candles.
Correct.
Tell us about Rothstein and ties to organized crime.
Well, in the book, and I got to be careful what I say about organized crime, obviously, but Scott Rothstein was associated with both the Israeli mafia and the Sicilian mafia. And then when it came time that Scott Rothstein returned from his trip to Morocco, he was cooperating with the feds, and he brought down three Sicilian mobsters who are now all serving time in prison.
So he's had to change his identity?
It's believed that Scott Rothstein today has had plastic surgery to alter his identity, and he is obviously under an assumed name in prison. Probably it's a prison in the Midwest somewhere where, you know, there's not a whole lot of mobsters, because they don't take it lightly when you turn in their guys.
When you say he was involved with the mob, what do you mean? He took money? Did he get money from them as well to put into the scheme?
Well, it's believed that there were money laundering activities that involved the mob. And then one of his associates, who was part of the Israeli mob, was an investor with Rothstein in a hotel on Fort Lauderdale Beach.
So he was really pretty deeply involved with the mob.
You know, there are a lot of pictures of Scott Rothstein in your book, Chuck. And looking at those pictures, of course, I have hindsight. I'd say I wouldn't buy a used car from this guy. He just looks kind of like he's a crook. But
Well, not only that, but it was the way...
And the bling. And...
Well, the watches. I must share with you, Joe, that my public relations firm is on Las Olas, three blocks from Rothstein's offices in the Bank of America building. And when I would go by that restaurant, Bova, that he also owned, Scott Rothstein would be out there at lunchtime with martinis. If I would go by there to make a bank deposit in the middle of the day, Scott Rothstein was there having martinis in the middle of the day. And then after working a 10-hour day, if I was to go by that restaurant, Scott Rothstein would still be there having martinis. This...
Did you ever join him?
No. You know, I kept an arm's length distance from this guy because supposedly he was a successful CEO of a law firm with 150 employees, but he was having martinis at all times of the day.
So did that raise questions for you?
It did. It did. Bonnie, and one of the things I started asking questions, the first thing I wanted to know how the law firm was so successful. I was told that the law firm was doing business deals. And so then I would look in the newspapers, the Daily Business Review, the South Florida Business Journal. There were no deals. I couldn't find any. So then I pushed further. I don't see any of these deals in the newspapers.
And yet he was a control freak, and yet he was having martinis all day.
Well, exactly. I was then told that they were involved with internet companies and that the law firm was successful due to the results of these internet companies. One of them was called QTask. There was only one problem with that. QTask was a startup internet company. So there was no way it was bringing in millions of dollars. And then, frankly, in the end, the rumor was that he was involved with pornography. And I've been told pornography...
The biggest moneymaker on the internet.
Correct. So at that point, I just said to myself, I'm going to keep my distance from this man.
We're speaking with Chuck Malkus. He's a public relations executive and president of Malkus Communications Group. His book is entitled The Ultimate Ponzi, The Scott Rothstein Story. It's Topical Currents. We need to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. And once again, we resume our conversation with Chuck Malkus. We're talking about the book, The Ultimate Ponzi, The Scott Rothstein Story. Chuck, how about a website where we can learn more about the book and you?
Certainly. It's simply ultimateponzi.com is the book website. My public relations firm may be found at malkus.com. M-A-L-K-U-S.com.
So he amassed this fortune. How long did it take him to actually get this $1.4
billion? Billion with a B.
Yes. Well, less than a couple of years. And that's one of the reasons why it's the ultimate Ponzi. He was bringing in major hedge funds from New York to South Florida to Texas. Savvy investors who were writing big checks.
And what did he do with all this money? We know he had a lavish lifestyle. Tell us about that.
Well, he spent money buying million-dollar homes, not only in South Florida, but up in Nantucket, in the Northeast. He purchased not one Bugatti sports car, which costs $1.5 million. He purchased three. Of course, he had a Lamborghini, a Mercedes, motorcycles. He had the Princess
Yacht.
I was just going to say, Joe, the Princess Kimberly Yacht. He bought restaurants. He bought the Versace Mansion. He bought shares in hotels on Fort Lauderdale Beach. He bought just about anything that you could imagine, including pay for women who he had at his disposal to entertain his friends and investors.
How extensive was that, this female companionship network that he established?
Well, it was very extensive, Bonnie. And in a June 2012 deposition, Scott Rothstein stated for the record that he spent over $60,000 a month on pay for women. And he had a sex pad a block away from his office where they would retreat in the middle of the day or in the evening. And he had the women from Miami Companions, which the feds later described as being one of the largest escort agencies in the United States. Scott Rothstein was not only their attorney, he was their best client.
So what was his relationship with law enforcement? Why wasn't he, you know, at least looked at from that angle?
Well, that is one of the ongoing investigations, and it is believed that at least one law enforcement official with the Broward Sheriff's Office will eventually be indicted.
Let's go back to his law partner, Stuart Rosenfeld. Was he actually another victim of Rothstein's?
I believe that Stuart Rosenfeld was the first victim, and this is expressed in the Ultimate Ponzi book in the second chapter, because Stuart Rosenfeld was a successful attorney who had an outstanding reputation and could have stayed with the Phillips firm in Hollywood, Florida. But Scott Rothstein befriended him, made him feel like a family member, and unfortunately used his good name.
Originally, Stuart had mixed feelings about him. Something made his skin crawl when he first met Rothstein, and he didn't trust that judgment.
Well, that's correct. They were at a convention, I believe, over in Tampa, and just the way that Scott Rothstein could come across was with arrogance and somebody that, you know, was smarter or knew more or who was better, and that could be a turnoff.
So what happened to Stuart Rosenfeld? Where is he now?
Well, he's still practicing law, and I will share with you that I did spend time with Stuart and his attorney, Bruce Lear, with taped interviews, and I was hesitant at first to believe that he couldn't have known anything. However, after spending several hours with Stuart, I do believe that he was the first victim.
We've been promoting this program. I wonder if someone gave him a heads up and he may be listening now.
Well, he may be listening, or his mom or his current wife, Kim, may be listening. I will share with you, I gave a presentation at the Museum of Art, and Mrs. Gay Rothstein, his mother, was sitting in the front row. And she had many questions, and she shared information. And after it was over, I then spent about a half hour with his mother. And I think for her, it was probably more about closure, but I wouldn't be surprised if one or three of them
What were she like?
You know, she told me that laughter was the best medicine. She still looks at Scott as being her son who couldn't do wrong. She did express to me that the truth would come out and that those who were also involved would be arrested.
So she said, you said she asked you questions. Did you actually answer questions for her that she didn't know?
I believe so. And at part of it, at one time in this presentation, and again, we're at the Museum of Art. There's about 80 people who were there. I'll admit first, she was sitting in the front row, and I thought to myself, I have met this woman before. And then it started clicking, and because of the questions that she was asking, specifically about one of the deaths that are part of this story, it then all suddenly clicked. I had, at the courthouse, been in the elevator with her. And then I asked her to come to the front of the room because I wanted to give her a microphone so that she could talk about what happened to the attorney, Melissa Lewis, who was murdered early on. And she basically stated that that Deborah Villegas, whose husband Tony committed to murder, had been abused and had was somebody who unfortunately was a victim. And she stated this publicly in front of everyone. And it was unusual. But I will share with you every week there is something else unusual with this case that comes to my attention.
You mean more repercussions that are just that are ongoing now?
Yes. One of them would have to be the pending court dates of Scott Rothstein's current wife, Kim Rothstein, who has pled guilty to fencing $1 million of jewelry. And I go to these trials, and the one thing I'll never forget is that back in January of 2010, after a Scott Rothstein hearing outside the federal courthouse, Kim Rothstein held a news conference to state how she was innocent and to state how she didn't know anything.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And at the same time, she was in the process of fencing jewelry. This, after November of 2009, I came face to face with Kim Rothstein at a jewelry store on 17th Street Causeway. I had received a call from a friend that she had arrived at this jewelry store. She was at the counter with 12 men's watches, six-figure watches. She was having them resized to become women's watches. Okay? She turns around from the counter, and I reintroduce myself, and she says, "Well, you know what, Chuck? I can't go anywhere. I can't even go and get batteries for my watches. Well, these watches don't require batteries."
So this was just last Friday that she pled guilty, wasn't it?
This past Friday, actually, her sentencing was scheduled, but it has been delayed because she is now singing like a canary, and it's believed that Kim is turning evidence against co-conspirators as part of this fencing of the $1 million of jewelry. But here's the unusual thing about this. Typically, when someone flips, it starts from the bottom and goes to the top. Kim was responsible for organizing this conspiracy, and now she is singing against the people that she brought into the conspiracy.
Mm. So do you think she's going to serve time, or will she get...
I think she's going to serve time. She's facing 5 years. She should get at least 2 years, but she may end up with 1 year and 1 day in prison.
And how did they become a couple before we take our break?
Right. Well, they met at the Blue Martini, where Kim was a bartender, and Scott courted Kim Rothstein, the bartender.
And, very attractive woman.
I suppose, you know, she's spent a lot of money with physicians to enhance her figure. And
I'm just going by the pictures in your book, Chuck.
Well, the reason for all of the Kim Rothstein pictures in the book is that sometimes a picture is worth 1,000 words. And she's there in one picture with shopping bags. This is a woman who spent $800,000 on her American Express card over a period of 4 years.
We're speaking with Chuck Malkus. He's a public relations executive, crisis communications expert, community advocate, and president of Malkus Communications Group. The name of the book is The Ultimate Ponzi, The Scott Rothstein Story. Going to take another break. Stay with us on Topical Currents. We'll be right back.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Chuck Malkus. He's the author of The Ultimate Ponzi, The Scott Rothstein Story. Chuck, you brought up about murders, specifically Melissa Britt Lewis. Had they been tied to the Rothstein scandal?
Well, there's several rumors out there which tie it to the scandal. It's important to point out that first Tony Villegas, the accused, has not gone to trial yet. And so the rumors have to do with the fact that Scott Rostein was a very manipulative person. Scott Rostein had the ability to convince you of something, whether it was true or not. And so it is believed by some that Scott Rostein could have lit a fire under Tony Villegas, expressed to him that Miss Lewis was responsible for his divorce, that Miss Lewis was responsible for a number of things.
Was she a partner in the firm?
She wasn't a partner. She was an attorney who was well-respected and well-liked, and also an attorney who, if she would have caught wind of this Ponzi scheme, she absolutely would have reported it to authorities. So if Melissa Lewis started asking questions, if she may have caught wind that something didn't add up here, then Scott Rostein could have figured out, uh-oh, one of the attorneys has figured this out. Now what do I do? Now, these are theories which are unproven, which...
He hasn't gone to trial.
And he hasn't gone to trial. Now, I will tell you, and again, as I investigated the ultimate Ponzi, I went to the state attorney's office first with a public records request. I requested the cell phone records of Tony Villegas for 1 week prior to the murder. And so they called and said, come on down. There was a file with over 100 pages of cell phone records. But I will tell you that one-third were redacted. They simply were blacked out. I had with me, you know, seven of Scott Rostein's phone numbers, his two cellulars, his private lines at the office, the other office lines that Rostein would use. But with the redacted phone numbers, there was no way I could determine if Scott Rostein ever had contact with Tony Villegas.
And who did that censoring of the records?
The state attorney's office did, because there is an ongoing investigation. There is a trial, which has not happened yet. After this trial happens, I will go back with that same request and see if there were phone calls from Scott Rostein to Tony Villegas.
And there were other murders.
Yes.
Tell us about those.
Well, tragically, there were three murders with this law firm of 150 employees. And I first need to state that I am not aware of another company in the United States where there's 150 employees and then tragically three are dead. Now, the other two murders were individuals who took their own lives. One was an aspiring law student who, her name is Julie Timmerman. She had dreams of becoming an attorney. She clerked at the law firm. And then when this came crashing down, she took her own life. And the other individual who took his life was a bodyguard of Scott Rostein's, who also, after this came crashing down, chose to take his life.
Do we know why?
So he possibly thought he would be prosecuted.
Yeah, we don't know why, Bonnie. And it's a very sad circumstance that perhaps we'll never know.
But they were definitely suicides, the other two.
Yes.
Ruled as suicides.
Yes.
Tell me, Chuck Malkus, what about the charities that were part of the structured payout Ponzi scheme and the money that they accepted?
Well, what happened, Joe, with this Ponzi is that Scott Rostein wrote large checks to charitable organizations. The checks included $1 million to Holy Cross Hospital, included about $800,000 to the Joe DiMaggio Children's Hospital. Mm-hmm. Several checks to the Boys and Girls Club. These charities had to return every dollar, despite the fact that the money had been spent on services. There were smaller charities who received large checks. One which had to lay off an employee, another one that had to cut back services because they had already spent this money that Rothstein had given to them.
Right. But still they had to give it back.
They still had to give it back.
Any other charities? Are they still suffering? So some of them are still feeling the repercussions today.
Well, it takes time to recover from something like this. And frankly, there was over 24 charities. And I'm not going to name the smaller ones today because, you know, charities have a special place in my heart. I founding co-chairman of Neighbors for Neighbors and involved with organizations like Junior Achievement and the American Red Cross. I will tell you this. Scott Rothstein asked one of his attorneys to approach Neighbors for Neighbors about being the title sponsor of our organization. Mm. And this came up at a board meeting, and I said, well, wait, hold on. We don't know where this guy's money is coming from. And so if he's interested in being our sponsor, let him come to a board meeting and explain his interest, and then I am going to ask that question. Of course, Scott Rothstein never came to one of our meetings.
And he didn't want his feet held to the fire, then.
Exactly.
No. And when was that? How long before his
demise?
Yeah, that was in 2008, early 2008.
So what did happen in Halloween of 2009 exactly? How did this start to crumble?
Certainly. Well, it was actually the week of Halloween, and then Halloween night was that weekend. Scott Rothstein was not paying his bills at his restaurant. Number one. Number two, lawyers who were submitting expense account reports also were not being paid. And there was a buzz in the air. Something is about to happen. On the Thursday night, there was actually an event being held at his house, which was the annual gift-giving guide event. And I'll share with you, I got that invitation in the mail. And I said, clear my calendar. This is one event I'm not going to miss. On that Thursday, Scott had already fled to Morocco and simply was not at the event. And Scott Rothstein never missed an event. And there was a buzz at that party at his mansion. And then when the week ended on Friday, investors were not being paid. Checks were overdue. And things came crashing down on Saturday when it was learned that he had basically emptied all law firm accounts, including trust firm accounts, that he was in Morocco, a country without an extradition treaty to the United States.
Why didn't he stay there?
Well, it's believed that his parents would have been threatened by the mobsters who he had ripped off. And that's the only reason why he got back on a private jet and flew to South Florida along with the $20 million that he had taken with him.
And what happened to that?
Cash.
Right.
Oh, my. And what happened to that $20 million? Did that go back to the mob? Was that the mob's money?
Well, the feds took that $20 million and confiscated it. And it was basically... Scott Rothstein, when he did come back, one of the things he proclaimed was that he was going to make everybody whole, that he, you know, had done some terrible things, but that everybody was going to get their money back.
And?
You know, this is going to be one of the few Ponzi schemes in United States history where investors may receive as much 85%, 90%, and the reason being that TD Bank has been alleged in court documents by investors to be the financial epicenter of the Ponzi scheme. And as of today, TD Bank has already been hit with $330 million that they're having to pay. And there still is over a dozen lawsuits against TD Bank.
We're speaking with Chuck Malkus. His firm is Malkus Communications Group. He's a public relations executive. And the name of the book is The Ultimate Ponzi, The Scott Rothstein Story. One more short break, and we'll be right back.
And we return 47 minutes past 1 o'clock. It's today's topical currents. Bonnie Berman, Joseph Cooper, along with Chuck Malkus. And we're talking about the Ponzi schemer, Scott Rothstein. Chuck Malkus has written The Ultimate Ponzi, The Scott Rothstein Story. First up, we have Steve in Palmetto Bay. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I interviewed with Scott Rothstein. He was looking to open an office in Miami at one point and want to get some politically connected attorneys to help him open it. At one point, a lot of the county commissioners were my clients. So I went up to interview with him. He kept me waiting, took me into this room that, you know, you had to go past a double set of locked doors. And he basically was just all about himself. And when he explained, I'd done employment discrimination cases. And when he explained how they made money, that they sold off the income stream from these settlements, I nodded, talked to him for a bit, and when I talked to my recruiter, I said, no thanks, I'm not interested because I've handled these things. You typically get the amount of money you would have made had you not been discriminated against, plus attorney's fees, but nobody gets millions of dollars in these things. I mean, and so it just smelled. Hmm. And then a few months later, everything blew up, so... Well, I'm wondering why nobody else caught on to this.
Well, Steve, you're obviously an intelligent gentleman. And there, in the Ultimate Ponzi book, there's another attorney, Stephanie Toothaker, who expresses pretty much what you just explained, Steve. And, you know, it's sad for the legal community what happened. The book is about lessons learned. And hopefully... the book will keep this from happening again in any other community in our country.
Okay. Thank you, Steve.
Thanks for your call.
What do you think it is about South Florida that makes us so vulnerable to these kind of Ponzi schemes?
Greed.
Well, yeah. Bonnie, I think maybe more than anything, we open our arms and we welcome people to South Florida. And I think that in some cases... there's an affinity crime that happens. That's where this begins. In other words, either a neighbor of yours, someone from your church or synagogue says, you know what, this guy has down a investment opportunity, which I'm a part of, and you should be a part of it too. And unfortunately, what's happened is that people have ignored red flags. The caller, Steve, that we just heard from, explained what he witnessed and what he saw, and his gut feeling said there's no way. In the Ultimate Ponzi book, there's another attorney I mentioned, Stephanie Toothaker. The same thing happened with her. So some of us go with our gut feeling as opposed to relying on that neighbor or church member.
You know, in the difference between Rothstein and Madoff is that Madoff would turn people down. People were begging him to be a part of it. He was very selective.
Correct. And Madoff made people to feel that they were joining a special club. But let's realize this. Bernie Madoff had been chairman of NASDAQ. He was very well respected, who had earned the respect that he received.
Right.
Scott Rothstein was not only an overnight philanthropist, but he was an unknown attorney who came into Fort Lauderdale and became a power broker based on writing checks that were with other people's money.
And the other difference I'm thinking, Bernard Madoff was the kind of person you would trust because he had this avuncular kind of way about him, whereas Scott Rothstein, it just seems who would trust him with that, you know, ostentatious manner and the bling and the women and the... It just seems so incomprehensible.
Correct, Bonnie. Scott Rothstein was a cartoon character who paraded around in Dick Tracy-like suits.
Mm. You think it was his hubris that ultimately got him, that got him caught, this may have continued. He just let the guard down or something, or he was just too out there?
Correct, Bonnie. That's exactly what happened. And frankly, he was a womanizer. And I will share with you that there's no way that you're going to be able to run a company with 150 employees, let alone a $1.4 billion Ponzi scheme, while having a half dozen girlfriends, utilizing the services of an escort agency, and think that you're going to be able to manage your business. It's not possible.
Tell us about your efforts to interview Scott Rothstein for the book.
Certainly. When things came crashing down and returned, I had Scott's cellular number. I called. I left one message. Then I texted him, and Scott's response by text was, "Well, you don't know me." And I responded back, "Well, that's the reason why you need to talk to me." And his response was, good luck on your book." I then called his attorney, Mark Nurek, on several occasions. The last conversation with his attorney was, "Mark, we're going to go to press with what we have, unless you make Rothstein available." And Mark Nurek says, "Well, we'd have to read your book before we made Scott Rothstein available." And as a journalist,
you can't do that.
No, you can't do that. The times that I met Scott Rothstein, I've got to tell you, he was like a snake oil salesman. And he had a twitch. This guy had a nervous twitch unlike I've seen by any professional.
Well, what was it?
I think that he always was thinking of his next move, his next investor, his next girlfriend. This guy was just unlike anyone else I'd ever seen in South Florida.
Why did he get such a light sentence compared to Madoff? Is it because he sang the way he did?
Correct, Bonnie. He was facing 100 years in prison based on his cooperation with the feds in nailing three mafiosos. His sentence was 50 years. And Scott Rothstein's going to go back a second time for a resentencing based on recent cooperation. But, you know, it all comes down to the harm that this man did, the lives that he destroyed, the fact that he forged federal judges' signatures. And the current judge, Judge Kahn, I don't believe is going to take that lightly. When you forge a federal judge's signature.
What circumstances did he do that?
There was a lawsuit, and he created a judge's order to show to a client, and it had a fake federal judge's signature. Mm. I mean, this guy, Scott Rothstein, was over the top, and nothing would keep him from achieving his goal of bringing in money.
What makes you think he's in a federal facility somewhere in the Midwest? Of course, he doesn't even have a federal prison locator number.
Well, that's correct, Joe. I believe that he's at a prison in the Midwest because it would have to be a place where there wasn't hardened criminals or mafia convicted.
So it would be like a Marion, Illinois.
Yeah, it's up. I've been asked this question, and I could only project. I can't say for certain.
Is he eligible for parole, by the way?
No.
Okay. That's good to know.
Well, we certainly want to thank you. It's been a very interesting hour. Also, our apologies to callers we couldn't get on the air. Once again, Chuck Malkus, how about a website where people can learn more about you and the book?
Okay. Well, the book website is simply ultimateponzi.com. My public relations firm may be found at Malkus.com. That's MALKUS.com.
Once again, the name of the book, The Ultimate Ponzi, The Scott Rothstein Story. Chuck Malkus, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And that's our program for today. We thank you for spending your time with us. We hope you enjoyed the rebroadcast. Our producer is Richard Ives, with technical direction from our online producer, Paul Leary. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org, and more information, links, and photos at the Topical Currents Facebook page. That's facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Tomorrow's Topical Currents begins with an FAU English professor, Andrew Furman. He's written Bitten, My Unexpected Love Affair with Florida. Also, Linda Gassenheimer looks at what's in store for school meals and after-school activities this year. Join us then. Bonnie Berman, hoping your day is a great one. Please stay tuned for Here and Now, up next from NPR News.